Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 134 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling How Minneapolis Flour Milling Shaped Our World, about my tour through the Mill City Museum on the banks of the Mississippi River on a beautiful Minneapolis summer afternoon, June 26, 2019. It's easy to forget the profound transformation that occurred less than 150 years ago with the introduction of roller milling technology, not only for flour, but for Americans' diets. For those who don't know what roller milling is, a quick primer. Modern milling employs grooved steel rollers, which flake off the bran and germ, leaving endosperm, which is ground into various grades of flour. Before roller mills, stone mills were the method of grinding flour. It wasn't that long ago that the array of products made from refined wheat flour became America's new normal. Although it's hardly ancient history, our forgetfulness of the past is often so complete it needs a little nudge, like a museum, to help us recognize how far we've come and how our forebears made it possible. The Mill City Museum in Minneapolis provides a useful prodding, and I urge listeners who happen to find themselves in the Twin Cities to add the historic structure to their list of things to do. I was in Minneapolis for the Wheat Foods Council summer board meeting June 27th and 28th. We met in a room above the museum. The Wheat Foods Council is supported by the Washington Grain Commission as well as 39 other commissions, associations, and companies. It's dedicated to increasing wheat disappearance through education as well as by fighting disinformation. Winnie Freilich, who serves as an educational staff member at the museum, was my exhibit guide. I began my conversation with her on the ground floor of the museum that opens onto the ruins of the mill after it burned in 1991, a fire thought to have been started by homeless people taking shelter on a cold February night. Because the mill itself had closed down in 1965, the fire proved to be a blessing in disguise, as it provided the opportunity to move forward with building the museum as well as repurposing the remaining structure into offices and condos, which has in turn helped rejuvenate the riverfront. I've posted quite a few photos from my tour of the museum on the Washington Grain Commission Facebook page. Although I think the podcast stands on its own, seeing photographs never hurts. If you do take a gander, please like the page. And while you're at it, pass this podcast on to your older friends and landlords who might enjoy a look back at a history that only missed us by a little more than 100 years. Freilich and I begin our tour through the museum with me asking why Minneapolis is known as the Mill City.
Well, at one time, the city was filled with flour mills, sawmills, blanket mills, and they were all right here on the Mississippi River at St. Anthony Falls. So, lots of mills, Mill City.
How many mills were there?
At one time on this side of the river, there were 32. They weren't all flour mills. Mostly they were flour mills, though.
Mm-hmm. And the wheat was coming from where?
Well, it was coming from the bonanza farms of northern Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota. And when I say bonanza farms, that was really the beginning of what you can think of as industrial farming. When that land opened up, perfect for growing wheat, flat as the eye could see, no trees, and then the railroad went through, railroad crashed, needed money. So they went back to the people who invested and said, hey, would you like some of the land that we were granted by the government? Pennies on the dollar. Come on out and become a wheat farmer. So then, huge farms, 1,500 acres, 20,000 acres, 150,000 acres. That's where that began. Growing wheat all came to Minneapolis.
And why Minneapolis? Why not the other direction? Or why, I mean, you know, this is not the most populated part of the country.
You are exactly correct. Well, we have something very special right here in what was St. Anthony before it became Minneapolis. That's the city that was annexed by Minneapolis, was the first city that was settled right here. And of course, let's acknowledge there were people here before us, the Dakota people, the Anishinaabe, the Ojibwe, really consider this a very special and spiritual place because of the thing that happens in one place on the entire length of the Mississippi, the waterfall.
Really? This is the only place you have a waterfall?
Well, there is Little Falls, but it's called Little Falls for a reason.
Okay, so we're in a courtyard right now, and it looks like and some ancient relics here, you know, walls that do not have buildings attached to them. Right. What are we looking at here?
Well, you are looking at the ruined courtyard of the Washburn Crosby A Mill, flour mill. Right, situated right, as I said, on St. Anthony Falls. Mississippi River is right outside the door that we were looking out. And because they were right next to the waterfall, it meant the drop in geography, built huge flour mills here. And this mill looks like this, like a ruin, because it's been reconstructed after a fire that happened in 1991. So half of our building is a building that has offices and the museum in it, and then the other half is this beautiful courtyard where we have outdoor activities, weddings, receptions, concerts, and other events.
Let's walk over to the entrance here, and you can describe for me what we're seeing here across the street and the river.
This building was 9 floors high, city block wide, and probably 2 city blocks long, if you can imagine this. And right now we're walking out to what was once a wooden road that covered a water canal. And the water is diverted away from the waterfall into a man-made canal that ran in between 2 rows of mills, mostly flour mills. And then underneath that road is where the water came into the building, then fell down into basically the shore, 40 feet, turning a turbine, then turning a bevel gear, which in turn powered the entire building. And this is all run from water power. All of those mills that we mentioned earlier, water power.
And so 100 years ago, would we have been looking at a line of mills along this river right here?
Yes, you would have been looking at, specifically across the street from us, about 15 smaller mills with one turbine inside, each milling its own flour. Some of them owned by the Pillsbury Company, which now we can see across the river. You're looking at 2 big behemoth companies that started right here, Pillsbury, and then the Washburn Crosby Company became General Mills, staring each other down across the Mississippi River.
Fascinating, fascinating. Okay, where are we now?
We have come into the Mill City Museum proper, what we call the museum gallery. And this is where we have collections of artifacts. We have examples of the machinery that was used in flour milling. We have a water lab where you can put your hands into the water and see the many ways that people used the river and manipulated the river to make it work for those flour mills and make the power. Then we also have our baking lab where we make things every day for our visitors so that you can enter in a conversation about what wheat does.
All right. All right. Well, let's go up to this first exhibit right here. What are we looking at here?
You are looking at a collection of milling machinery. Now, of course, they never would have appeared like this because they are all on one floor. Each one of these machines would have been on separate floors of the mill in a what they call the gradual reduction process. And so wheat comes in at the top of a mill, goes down to the bottom through a roller mill and up and down as it is slowly peeled apart into its pieces. And you get flour at the end and then the byproducts like bran and germ. So you are looking at a packer from the 1800s, roller mills. There is a dust collector and a purifier. Now, here's the thing about this mill. The mill that was here before this one exploded.
The mill exploded.
The mill itself exploded in 1878, 2 years after it was built. A little bit smaller than this one. And that mill exploded, they determined the cause to be rampant flour dust. So, after the explosion, the owner C.C. Washburn, comes, looks at the hole in the ground where his business used to be and says, you know what? I'm going to rebuild. I'm going to rebuild twice the size. It is going to be bigger and better. I'm going to send a young engineer named William Delabarre over to Europe. I'm going to see what they're doing over there milling flour. So William Delabarre goes over there, and guess what he does? He steals the technology. There's a longer story to that, but that's the bottom line of it.
Shades of the Chinese.
Yes, a little bit. It's, you can see many things are still the same. So he comes back with this roller mill technology. Before this point, mills are making kind of a low-grade flour. They're using stone mills, and we have some examples of those here. They... William Delabarre brings back this technology. Then there's some industrious men in Iowa who are developing a system that uses air and sifters together that makes even purer white flour. Mr. Washburn makes a plan to put it all together. And what happens is they put it all together in this mill. They make the gradual reduction process. And we say in our little mission statement here on the wall, more than 100 years ago, converging forces made Minneapolis the flour milling capital of the world. Whoever you are, wherever you're from, what happened here continues to shape your world because it changed how people ate forever, that process.
Fascinating, fascinating. So the first Washburn mill, that wasn't a roller mill?
It was not. It had stone mills in it. I'm sure you've heard the term run of the mill. That's where that comes from, is that wheat runs through the mill through multiple different processes. So they had only stone mills at that time when that mill exploded.
And now over here, is this a stone mill that we're looking at, or a stone from a stone mill?
Yes, we are looking at a reconstructed stone mill. All of these were in pieces, of course, when we were able to obtain stone mills for the museum. And what millers used to do is when they would decommission one of these stone mills, they would actually put it in the ground outside of our building, and they made a plaza where the company band would play. So we have this from that excavation. And as you can see, this is in pieces. So they would ship these from France. And then come here, then stone cutters would cut the designs in them, whatever they were going to be used in for the milling, the type, different types of wheat. And so it's a very, let's see, it's about 4.5 feet across, and it's pretty heavy. I've never had to move it, thank goodness, in 16 years of being here.
So is the fact that it is in pieces to allow the flour to fall through?
Actually, what would happen is this... There would be two, on one on top of this, and the flour flows through a hole in the top one, and it rotates. The top one rotates, bottom one stays stable. And then the flour, as it's made, as it's crushed by the stone mill, moves outward, and so it's, and then it's gathered up on the outside.
So when this was put together, the seams were so tight that they...
Yes.
Okay.
The seams were so tight, and then they put a layer of plaster over that as well.
Really?
Yes. So then you have this tiny, tiny, smooth, smooth, smooth layer of plaster, right? And then that's another reason that a lot of people would grade their wheat differently or advertise their wheat flour and say no byproducts, no stone, no...
plaster.
Yes, no plaster, right? So that's what they would do with this. And so they would seal up all those teeny tiny little holes and those seams. But yes, it would fit together tight.
Wonderful, wonderful. So what other interesting pieces of equipment do you have?
One that I love personally is we have a Humphrey man lift. And this is one of our newer exhibits because this was removed from the Pillsbury Mill across from us when they started to redevelop that into housing. Now, the man lift, I think, has a great story. There was a man working in a mill, and of course, there's no way to get up and down the stairs except the stairs. And so he invents this machine to be like a personal elevator. And so millers cut holes through each floor. They install this thing. It's basically like a conveyor belt. Like if you go to the grocery store and you're going to stand this up on end and put a step on it and a handle.
Was this also operated by water?
It was, yes. Yes. Everything ran off of belts and pulleys off of different drive shafts on different floors.
It was like the water was electricity.
Yes, it was the power. We were powered by water, by falling water.
And, I mean, I've seen man lifts in modern flour milling operations.
Absolutely, but most of the mills are now taking them out because of safety reasons. Because you can imagine, there's nothing around you. There's no cage, there's anything. And so these are becoming obsolete in flour mills.
Okay, so are we looking at a sifter here? This might be a sifter.
This is a purifier, the one I mentioned that has air. So it's air plus sifters working together. And let's walk around this side and we can give the inventors credit. The purifier really was one of the pieces that made making fine flour possible. And so it was George Christian who was working on that. And then George Christian hired a French immigrant, Emin Lacroix, and they built these Midlings purifiers in the Cannon River Valley, south of the Twin Cities. And he wasn't really the first to make these machines, but each step improved on the efficiency of the other, and as a result, kind of increased Minneapolis's ability to become a major contender in making flour in the world. We were the flour milling capital of the world for 50 years.
Everything about this operation makes refined flour, correct? And refined flour is not whole wheat flour. Now, that changed everything in terms of how Americans ate, correct?
It did. Sometimes I like to think about it in an economic way. So before this point, if you're milling with stone mills, you're getting a crushed seed. So all three pieces of a wheat seed are in that process. And so millers, from what I've heard, will call that ash. They'll have extra in it. Once you get all of these processes together, you can separate those pieces and get the flour that we associate with making cakes and white breads now, just faster, efficiently, and cheaper. Now imagine this. Before, when you're using stone mills, it's a very time-consuming process. It's labor-intensive to get that fine white flour. So who can afford that? Your upper classes. Right? They get fine pastries and things like that. And your lower classes are getting the flour that has more of those byproducts in it. So then, once all of this is invented, everybody can afford that fine white flour. And suddenly, you get companies competing with each other. And now, you have logos and slogans and all kinds of marketing leap into play to make sure that someone thinks that your white flour is so much better than someone else's. So, it levels the playing field economically. But what else does it do? It reduces the nutritional content of that flour. And as time went on, then you had nutritionists, chemists discovering that this is happening, and now they tell us, eat that whole grain, it's better for you.
Yes, yes, and that's why we put in all of the things we take out.
Yes, folic acid, fibers, and things like that. So it's enriched flour is what that's called.
Right, right. Let's go on to the next exhibit that you want to show to me. Wow, this is something.
Well, this is our steam engine, and it's one of the biggest pieces that we have in the museum. And we have four areas for the museum. One is really talking about the supply or farming. Then we talk about the machinery and the water power. Then we also talk about advertising. And then we talk about the development of food in our baking lab. This is really starting with the farming, and I love this piece. It was restored. It was found in a swamp. The Historical Society helped take it out of the swamp and refinish it and restore it and bring it into the museum. And I don't know if you can stand here and look around. This is a pretty big piece, but it's one of the smallest steam engines that were manufactured. But the entire rest of the museum was basically built on scale to this piece. It's, I think, one of our highlights.
So I do want to talk to you about the marketing, because what you were saying over here is that basically when we made flour cheap, then the competitors had to go out and get customers. Mm-hmm. So could one look at the flour industry as the beginning of the marketing industry?
we do have a lot of examples in the museum about how these big flower companies competed with each other. And one of my favorite stories is that William Washburn sponsored a competition for flower. And it was held in Ohio. And he entered several of his flowers into the competition. There were other people that entered their flowers. And Mr. Washburn won the gold medal for his superlative flower. That's what it was called before that. So he came home and he named that flower the gold medal flower. And there was never another competition.
And we can still buy gold medal in the grocery store.
That's exactly it. He never sponsored another competition. So I think that's pretty good if you want to get your product named to be the gold medal.
What are we looking at here?
You are looking at what we call our Bonanza table. Now, we have a journal, a diary, from a woman named Mary Dodge Woodward. And this is a unique perspective from a domestic farm manager that tells us the story of what life was like on a wheat farm, one of these Bonanza farms, even though it was small, about 1,500 acres, from about 1883 to 1888, she kept this diary. Then her granddaughter published that diary into a book. So we have a history player here that portrays her, but we're looking at our Bonanza Farm table, which seats about 16 people and has a whole bunch of food on it. And this is to really show the amount of workers that it took on these grain farms at the time. And that one of our quotes is that they killed a pig and a hog, or a hog and a cow a week to feed these crews. That's a huge amount of meat. And Mary Dodge says, meat, bread, and potatoes. That's what'll keep the men working. Keep the women working as well. That's one of her quotes.
So here we are in the middle of a museum that is showing all these old-time artifacts, and yet on another portion of it, you have what looks like a very modern baking lab. Why?
Well, that's really part of the story of making flour. And, you know, all these companies started to compete, and they had to prove that their flour was the best. And one of the ways they did this was they would call their flour kitchen tested. So in the 1930s, 1940s, they're discovering all these things about nutrition, and they're trying to get that information out to the people, to the women typically, who are feeding their families. So they come up with this idea of test kitchens. They put women in these test kitchens, take pictures of them. They get women who have degrees in home economists, in chemistry. And so they say that our flour is better because it performs the same all the time. You put it in a recipe, it's gonna be fantastic every time. So we have a baking lab to try to tell that story about the test kitchens. Here, when General Mills moved to Golden Valley, Minnesota, they built a very large test kitchen with different themes, and you could tour those test kitchens. And they had the Kitchen of Tomorrow, and that's what our baking lab is modeled after, having everything just clean and white and glass. And so every day we bake bread or some other thing made with flour so we can talk about the test kitchen movement and the building of recipes, that to cookbooks and all the things these companies did to make sure that you were loyal to their product. We are going to head up to the 9th floor where you are going to love this view. All right, would you like to step outside and hear the roar of the falls?
Sure. Okay, so we're on the 9th floor here. Actually, we have a bird's eye view of the whole thing. What can you describe for me here?
This view from our 9th floor observation deck gives you a really good idea of how the waterfall has been constructed so that it will last forever. We are looking at, instead of a straight down waterfall, as is natural, we are looking at almost like a water slide. And that was put in by the Army Corps of Engineers. And also it has a horseshoe dam moving to the north of it. And that increased the amount of fall so that it could increase the amount of power here. So that is called a cofferdam. And then this water slide protects the limestone edge so that it will not erode back, and the waterfall will always be right here.
Looking at the improvements made by the Corps of Engineers to ensure the survival of the Mississippi Falls reminds me of the measures the federal agency has taken to ensure salmon survival, as well as the maintenance of dams and locks along the Snake Columbia River system. As I looked at the scene, I also thought of early Spokane and the importance of falling water in the founding of the city originally known as Spokane Falls. By 1870, Spokane had four water-driven flour mills in the downtown. The last mill was built on the river in 1902. The only mill that has survived was converted into shops and restaurants in 1973 and is now known as the Flour Mill. If you haven't visited before, you should. Clicker Daggers has great prime rib. I hope you've enjoyed episode 134, or what I entitled, How Minneapolis Flour Milling Shaped Our World. Please let your friends, landlords, and agribusiness contacts know about the episode, and if they haven't listened to a podcast before, teach them how to access the technology. And then join me here again next week for another episode of Weed All About It!
Out in the country where a woman's called a gal, she's more than a lover, she's a farmer's best pal. We marry them for life, we marry with a vow, and even in the night we know how to plow. Our children have two parents, our children have a home, they don't grow up with no edible syndrome. We're the backbone of this country, the spirit of its soul. Best you ask for whom the bell tolls. We feed you. We feed you.